from St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. This November, Missourians will get a chance to raise the state's minimum wage and put in place mandatory sick time for employees. Author and podcaster Heather McGee is a big fan of this initiative, and on the latest episode of Politically Speaking, she breaks down why passage of Proposition A could help a lot of people in the Show Me State. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
My promise to St. Louis was that I would do the absolute most for each and every person, starting with those who have the very least.
What I wanted to do was look and see what other states are doing.
We have to be willing to change those laws, that they are balanced and they affect everybody equally.
As somebody that grew up in the St. Louis area, in North St. Louis County, I didn't know any lawyers growing up.
We got to find long-term solutions to make government better, but also to be able to provide services to people.
I don't want to leave that federal money that we've been leaving all these years on the table.
We need to be spending this money to take care of Missourians.
I thought we accomplished a lot this year, but a lot more needs to be done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me from beautiful and scenic mid-Missouri, she covers all things state government and state politics for St. Louis Public Radio.
Sarah Kellogg.
And joining us today, she is speaking in favor of Missouri's minimum wage and paid sick leave initiative that will be before voters on November 5th. Our guest today is
Heather McGee.
Welcome to Politically Speaking, Heather. And before we talk about the initiative, can you just tell our listeners who you are, what you do professionally, and how you got attracted to speaking out for this campaign?
Yes, absolutely. Well, thanks so much for having me on. Again, my name is Heather McGee, and 3 years ago, I published a book called The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. And I devoted a whole chapter to the growing movement for workers' rights. And I spent a fair amount of time in Missouri talking to low-paid workers, profiling them, getting to know their lives, and how they really understood that as long as workers are divided by race, by neighborhood, pitted against each other, that they couldn't come together and fight for a better future. But that one of the most exciting movements for worker justice is actually happening in Kansas City. And that it is, since I profiled them in The Sum of Us, those workers in Stand Up KC who first fought for a minimum wage increase, the movement has gone statewide. And it's a massive coalition now. And so I wanted to come back and see what was going on. And I'm really thrilled to see the amount of broad-based support for something that should be common sense, which is that people should not work all day and come home in poverty, and they should be able to earn sick time to take care of themselves and their loved ones.
So you mentioned that the movement to increase Missouri's minimum wage, which I've followed off and on for the last decade. I don't know if you have like seen other movements in other states, but I'd be interested if you have, how it compares elsewhere.
It's a great question. You know, the Fight for 15, which is how the movement to raise the minimum wage to a decent living wage is known across the country, really sparked off more than 13 years ago. It started in New York City. I was actually there in Times Square at the first fast food strike. And it has really spread across the country. The reason why I wanted to tell the stories of workers in Kansas City is because they explicitly understood that some of the racial divides, some of the rural-urban divides, some of the just cultural divides had historically made it hard for workers to come together and do what no worker can ever do by themselves, which is get a raise, right? I talked to workers at Wendy's and Burger King who had worked there for decades and literally not been able to get a dollar an hour raise over decades because they were just asking for it for themselves. And it wasn't until workers came together across lines of race, across the neighborhoods, and were able to explicitly say, you know what, we won't be divided. We're going to stand up for each other. We're going to ask, demand this together, and we're going to go on strike. We're going to block the highways. We're going to do sit-ins at the, at municipal buildings. And they were able to raise the wage at the city level. And now, of course, here is the statewide ballot initiative.
This initiative would gradually raise Missouri's minimum wage from $12.30 an hour to $15 an hour by 2026. Why do you think this would be helpful for Missouri workers?
Well, right now, this increase would affect almost 1 in 4 Missouri workers. So if you think about it, you know, for so long, I think the impression was that minimum wage workers were, you know, teenagers just getting an extra job on the side. But these are parents with families. These are people who often have got at least some college under their belt, but have found that the most reliable available work is work for very profitable corporations that nonetheless have been willing to pay poverty wages. And so this is really long overdue in terms of the buying power of the average person in the state. It's kind of amazing how many workers would be affected by this, 1 out of every 4. And then of course there are spillover effects to neighborhoods and communities, right? Small businesses, you know, see customers walk through the door who've got a little bit more money to spend. Food banks can see, you know, their lines a little bit lessened because folks don't have to rely on food stamps because they're actually getting paid for the hard work that they do. We've seen all over the country that this minimum wage issue is one of the most studied in economics in my field. And, you know, the old adage used to be, oh, you can't raise the minimum wage because then everybody will lose their job, right? If workers have to be paid more, employers won't hire as many workers. Well, it's been studied and studied and studied both, you know, in the textbooks and in the real world. And that just hasn't been the case. It's really, really a win-win for businesses in many ways because they get more reliable workers, less turnover, higher productivity. Folks aren't worried about sleeping in their cars and having to have their utility bill shut off because they're not being paid enough for their work.
You know, about 10 years ago, businesses may have said that a $15 an hour wage, you know, minimum wage was unrealistic and hurtful for companies to survive financially, you know, but the COVID-19 pandemic dramatically changed the labor market. And you could make an argument that $15 an hour may not be enough in 2026 if inflationary pressures continue to exist. What do you make of that point?
I think that's a really good point, and that's why there's got to be a floor. I mean, the fact that right now, today, people are making a fraction of 15 is really unconscionable. And so there has to be that floor of 15, which the state will get to in 2026 when the ballot initiative is passed. But what's important is that the ballot initiative provides for annual increases based on the cost of living, right? So that people aren't running in place and getting behind if inflation rises. And so that's a really important piece of it. As well, of course, is the earned sick days piece. You mentioned the pandemic, right? We understand nowadays that people get sick, their loved ones get sick, your child has to stay home. And if they don't have the ability to do that without, you know, missing a whole day's pay or risking their job, there are cascading impacts, you know, in that family, you know, for the customers who walk in and somebody's coughing over them. You know, it's really just, it should be a bare minimum in a country like ours. And it's so important to get that floor of being able to have workers earn 5 and as much as 7, depending on the size of their employer, paid sick days to be able to care for themselves and their loved ones and get healthy.
So there, I'm sure that there are other states that require paid sick leave. What have you found in terms of businesses actually adhering to these guidelines? I don't think there are any specific punishments detailed in this initiative about what would happen if a company didn't adhere to it. But I also think that it would empower like state agencies to make sure it's in effect. And I guess those state agencies could, you know, use the stick of state government, so to speak, to make them comply. So it's a two-part question, but I'd be interested in your answer to both of them.
Yeah, we have had a number of states across the country pass these requirements for earned sick leave, and enforcement is an important piece of it. First of all, the data shows that workers tend not to even take as many as 5 days. You think 5 days is not a lot? I have a small kid. Certainly he's out 5 days, at least 5 days every, you know, cold and flu season from school. But, you know, workers who are struggling to get by oftentimes, you know, don't take the full amount. And they do what they can to stay on their feet and to work as much as possible. So, you know, there's not this sort of rampant abuse of the minimal 5 days. We've really seen that. And then it is really important, Jason, I think you're so wise to bring up that, of course, there are lots of rules on the books that powerful bosses and employers ignore. Ultimately, because this is such a good policy for the long-term health of companies to not have workers being sick on the job, you would hope that employers would do the right thing and pay folks when they are have to be home sick or taking care of a loved one. But it does come up to, but come back to the issue of worker power, right? Can workers call the government, their government agency, the Department of Labor, Consumer Protection here in New York, where I am, workers can call the New York City Department of Consumer and Worker Protection. They just call 311 and they file a complaint. Sometimes, you know, a worker center or a workers organization, if they start hearing that there have been repeat abuses by an employer, they can, again, with collective power coming together, workers can say, hey, this employer is a bad actor. Unions can play that role, even for people who, you know, for workers who are not unionized, they can shine a light on bad employers. But it's really important, ultimately, that workers feel like they have the power to have a law that's on their side that they can then enforce to hold employers accountable if they try to flout the law.
And just for clarity, the initiative would give the Department of Labor and Industrial Relations oversight and enforcement power. So I want to make it clear that, like, there is an enforcement mechanism with an existing state governmental agency. I just wanted to make clear, too, because I've already talked with representatives from this campaign before, like, there's not specific punishments laid out if you do not adhere to this. I would imagine that that is something that those agencies can figure out internally without being dictated by statute. Because I'm almost positive they have the authority and power to make people comply to this without additional statute saying that they have to, basically.
That's right. Right. They don't need to add new language in the ballot initiative, but it is up to that government agency to enforce the law as soon as it's in place.
Now, I don't want to say that, like, requiring paid sick time is not important, because I'm sure that there are businesses that do not offer it right now that would offer it if it is put into law. But every job I've had since I got a college has had paid sick time, even ones that didn't pay very well. I used to work at Dillard's department store in Columbia, Missouri, and I'm pretty sure I had paid sick time for that, although that was 20 years ago and my memory is failing pretty mightily, so I could be wrong about that. It seems to me like, because of that, again, going back to the opposition question, the business groups and the usual suspects may not really be that upset over this change, as opposed to, let's say, this included like paid family leave, which is kind of a more complicated and contentious process, given that you may have to have a way to pay for that. So is it possible that this is kind of like an idea that has a lot of consensus within the business community? And if you wanted to do something more than this after that, you may have to think it out a little bit more rather than just attach it to a minimum wage initiative.
On one hand, you're right. This is a common sense in a business's self-interest idea to have earned sick days. Almost 500 businesses have signed up in support of the ballot initiative for good reason. But on the other hand, one in three workers in the state currently can't earn paid sick days. They don't have that right on the job. They don't have that benefit. So, you know, it's one of those things where when you are living and sweating in the low wage economy, you are much more likely to not have any option of a job that is going to allow you any paid time off at all. And so 1 in 3 is not nothing in the state. And I think that, you know, to your question about, you know, what's the sort of next step? Yes. I mean, I'm currently expecting, you know, my second child. The idea that I would have to, that I would have 5 earned sick days with my newborn before having to go back to work is, I can't imagine it's good for anybody, not for the newborn, not for my husband, not for the society as a whole, certainly not for my employer. And so I do think it's important that workers in Missouri, as they have been now for well over a decade, keep building power to be able to say, these are the things that families need for a decent life. This is what we need to be a healthy society. And when people come together and build that kind of collective power, right? It was collective worker and community power that got this initiative on the ballot, right? You know, it's not just businesses doing it out of the goodness of their hearts, right? 1 in 4 paid under $15 an hour. 1 in 3 doesn't have earned sick days. And so you do need organizations like the Missouri Workers Center and the Missouri Rural Crisis and all of these other groups across the state to come together to help people know how to, you know, exercise their own power to change the rules that shape all of our lives.
In the past 20 years or so, minimum wage increases have been put before Missouri voters and just passed overwhelmingly. And that primarily happens because even groups that are leery don't end up organizing an opposition campaign. Do you expect that to happen this time around as well?
It's my understanding that there hasn't been any organized opposition that's come out and, you know, flooded the airwaves and put the leaflets in the mail. And that's a good thing, right? This should be common sense. At the same time, you know, we're not at November 5th yet. And so people who support this idea and think families should have this kind of economic security and this kind of health security should make their voices heard and volunteer and door knock, go to Missouri Worker Center and be a part of the movement for doing the right thing. Because you never know, you know, when some billionaire decides that this is, you know, part of a movement across the country for workers' rights and they don't want to see it pass. You know, that could happen at any point. And so it's important for everyone to stay organized and stay focused.
What message would you have for businesses who may see something like this and maybe have apprehension, especially because the economy hasn't been particularly easy for them since COVID-19?
Research has shown, business school research from MIT, from Harvard, the lived experiences of the 450 businesses who signed on in support and businesses all across the country, that if your workers are less stressed about living in poverty and being unable to pay their light bill, feed their kids, avoid eviction, they show up more focused and are able to be more productive. You have less turnover if people don't have to quit because they aren't making enough, or they have to quit because they evicted and they're moving to the next county over. Ultimately, just as it is in the high wage economy, right, where, you know, employers fall all over each other to pay people great wages and benefits to retain talent, that's the same way that it is for just working class folks who are flipping burgers and, you know, driving trucks and waiting on tables and stocking shelves. You want good talent, you pay them, you reward them, you keep them, and it ultimately goes to your bottom line.
So the other two initiatives that raised the minimum wage that I've covered, they passed overwhelmingly, and the legislature didn't do anything with them because they passed so overwhelmingly. And I think that, like, even people that had misgivings about it eventually kind of lost the misgivings because the minimum wage rose to a level that really wasn't that quote unquote outrageous to them. But because it's a statute, it's still hypothetically possible for the legislature to repeal it if they want to. So what would be your message to legislators, especially if this passes overwhelmingly, to make sure this is preserved as opposed to changed because they don't like the policy? Hopefully that's a better question that you can answer, by the way. Okay, good.
The grassroots support all across the state for this initiative is so strong that this becomes a defining issue in voters' minds. And if the legislature were to step out and first reverse the will of the people, and second, push 1 in 4 Missouri workers back deeper into poverty, I think they should be very, very worried about making such a move. So, I think the organizers, ordinary folks, fast food workers who've gone on strike, rural farmers who've linked up arms with them, have really shown that, you know, ordinary people have power in the state and that the powers that be need to be on guard to anything that pushes, makes their lives worse.
What do you think is at stake on November 5th when it comes to this initiative?
You know, so often when we go to the ballot box, it feels like we're going to give some politician a job, right? But ultimately, this is a direct democracy example of having an opportunity to give, you know, ourselves, our cousins, our neighbors, a better job, a better life, a better shot at being able to save for their kids' college tuition. You know, this is really about whether or not families can, you know, just make it, or whether they're still, you know, pushed under. And so even if you are disgusted by politics, you want to tune out of politics, this is the kind of issue that should be able to get you, you know, A, to vote, obviously, on November 5th, but also to do a little bit more, you know, to give $5 to the campaign, to say, you know what, I'd love to have a yard sign in my window. I'd love to knock on doors or talk to my neighbors about this, because this really can make your neighbors' lives better.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on Politically Speaking. You can read all of our coverage of the 2024 election cycle in Missouri at stlpr.org. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. And Heather, how could people find out more about this initiative and anything else that they could learn before they go to the polls on November 5th?
Well, go ahead and look up the Missouri Workers Center. It's an organization of low-wage workers, Black, white, and brown, urban and rural across the state. And that is a hub for all the organizing for this initiative, which, you know, is already on the ballot because they work so hard to get Prop A on the ballot. And all you have to do is support it and go out and vote.
Thank you very much. And until next time, so long. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.